I want to explain the exciting dust and materials you can sprinkle into flames to make them change colours or burst out with little sparkles which shower into the sky. And this is part of the science behind a fun activity, introductory activity into science called making Harry Potter wands, where you put this dust in a little broomstick end, a little aluminium broomstick, which you put on the end of a match, and you heat the match up and it blows up with these sparkles and colours, coloured flames. So worthwhile things to do. But as with podcasts, it's a long journey of understanding to do all the groundwork. So halfway through an explanation, you don't say, oh, and by the way, this, you've done that foundation work. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. In this podcast, I'm going to go into what makes a flame coloured. Part of my cardiac rehab, I suppose, mentally structuring and getting a set number of podcasts out in a day to get my sort of cognitive mind working fast enough to get things through. So we can start things off by getting some table salt. You should be able to find some table salt and sprinkle that into a gas flame if you've got a gas stove top, or if you don't have a clear flame, a small amount of alcohol, methylated spirits in a dish, light that up. Be careful, it's an adult experiment. Light it up and sprinkle the sodium chloride, the table salt, into the flame, and it should go a beautiful yellow flame, a yellow colour. These are the yellows from the sodium doublet lines. There's a singlet and triplet resonance line down to the ground state of sodium. The excited electron in sodium goes down. So we want to discuss basically what makes a salt and what makes colour and why it's the iron, or the thing that gets ionized, which produces all the light in this experiment. So let's, without further ado, go into the periodic table. So if I can get you to, on your computer, pull up something called the dynamic periodic table. On your website, you'll see a periodic table. If not, you can have a periodic table in your book or on your wall. The dynamic periodic table has periodic different versions of the periodic table. Under something called properties, there's a tab up there called properties, and I'm going to discuss a little bit more. So what produces light is the very first thing. Obviously, this sprinkling something into the flame, it heats up and it emits light. And the emission of light is the actual individual atoms turning into antenna. So electromagnetic radiation from your mobile phone right down to atoms have to come from an antenna. This is an antenna is basically a electron which moves up and down, and in this case the electron is moving up and down in a different way in an atom. And so the way you put energy into your mobile phone emission is with a battery. With this, just the sheer heat energy of the atom of sodium, which has been sprinkled into your flame, and the sodium chloride, is sufficient for that electron to be pushed up and a transition. They called it a dipole transition moment. A dipole because it's a dipole antenna. Transition between one antenna state to another antenna state. So typically an atom can be an excited antenna state, and this antenna state is a non-radiative state. It's the state the electron, the atom stays up there with the energy captured in that state, and will undergo a dipole transition. And I suppose I have various YouTubes of various electron states transitioning with the electron. The atom actually appears to change shape, pulsate, and change shape as it changes from one orbital to another orbital. This is so electrons, rather than jumping from a circular racetrack from one outer circular racetrack to the other. In actual fact, are not individual points, but they're actually quantum mechanical shapes, and these shapes pulsate with their phase, and they change shape. And when they change shape, their pulsating shape changes. Light is emitted, and what's happening here is that we have sodium chloride, and sodium has this thing where obviously there's a sodium ion, and with no electron and an electron, it's up there. The sodium ion's in the gas, so a salt is sodium plus, chlorine minus, and in the flame, the sodium plus encounters a free electron. The electron goes in, and the electron falls down into the sodium, and so you get the neutral sodium being produced momentarily, and the light being produced. That's how you get a sodium transition line. So sodium plus is there's no electron in it. In the actual salt, the electron actually falls down into a ground state of neutral metallic sodium. So what's happening is that the yellow light is coming out, and when the yellow light comes out, a small little atom of unionized metallic sodium is produced. You've just got to think your way through it. So the reaction is Na, which is sodium, excited, goes to Na unexcited, plus a photon coming out. Prior to that, you've got sodium plus an electron goes to sodium excited. So you've got, that's the preliminary expanse. And so something's happening in a flame. And previously I've discussed that a flame is, a lot of people think it's fuel plus oxygen plus heat, but it's actually a zone where there is a whole lot of really reactive radicals produced. So the elements that you have, the stable elements, have broken down, and there's lots of radicals. So this there's sodium plus individual ions, there's electrons floating around the place, and when these recombine, you get the yellow produced. Now, so we have the big question back here, backing off a bit. We can sort of understand why sodium produces it, because the it doesn't take a lot to you've got a sodium plus ion, so sodium plus ion is something that's going to hit an electron. But then we have also the chlorine. Why doesn't the chlorine glow? In fact, sodium chloride and sodium fluoride look pretty much the same in a flame. It's the actual metal stuff, which is the positive ion, which produces all the heat. So when you actually go through the different salts, it's always the one which dominates the colour is the metal one. But we want to stop for a little while and actually talk about the various properties of atoms in the periodic table. And there's the standard periodic table, where everything is a neutral atom, and it's got its electron. And in a gas flame, we approximate this by things being reduced to their individual atoms. It's broken up to its individual atoms. Now, there's three. You've got a standard periodic table, which is your base zeroth table, and there's three different versions of the table, which I'm going to ask you to go to click to properties. And the first one is to click for ionization energy. So this is the amount of energy you have to put in to a into a neutral atom, a gas of neutral atoms, to actually remove its electron. You'll see that the ones which are most easier to ionize are the group 1 metals, and then it increases as you reduce the period or increase the group number of the periodic table as you go along. Fluorine is hard to ionize. Helium is the hardest to ionize. helium has the highest ionization energy as you move across. This is a good trend in the periodic table. So in terms of creating an ion in the first place, which can attract the electron to produce the light, the metals are easiest to ionize, and therefore the big candidates, the big plus, they're going to be the big plus ions in your radical zone, which is the flame area, which will then attract the electron and produce the light. So you can almost end your story there. But now we're here, if you click to over the next so the ionization energy version of the periodic table is fairly uniform. I think there's a few rises and bumps that you'll look out for, now we've got you here with the periodic table. The best is to actually then click on the next version of it. So that's the energy you have to put in to a system, an atom, to remove an electron. Now, the next one is electron affinity. So I've got neutral atoms, and just a whole lot of neutral atoms there, and forgetting the overall charge repelling, I can get a lump of negative charges if I'm allowed to do it, a lump of negative charges, and I just mix it in with these neutral atoms. So you can almost imagine, although it's, if you switch off your idea of the Coulomb charge repulsion, I have a beaker of electrons and a beaker of neutral atoms. I mix the two together, and what will happen is that almost every time it will produce energy. This will release energy. There's no example of where there's a reverse of this. It can be almost a no reaction with nitrogen or the noble gases or the noble metals. Noble metals in terms of this reaction. And this is electron affinity. And this is basically impossible to conceptualize with school or classical physics. I've got a neutral atom, and that which an equal number of electrons and protons. That should be all over because I've done my work of putting it in. But no, indeed, there is actually energy in space when things get close enough to actually put in an extra electron. So if I've got fluorine and I add an electron to it to make F minus, that will release energy. And the entire idea is that that is called electron affinity. Now, we've got another thing which we'll talk in a little while later, but we've got to go the steps. So these two tables, now at school you're showing the ionization energy. The other thing, which is more quantum mechanical, is the electron affinity. But those two mix together, and so if you can get a metal and a non-metal, a metal with a low ionization energy and a non-metal with a high electron affinity, you can actually mix those two together because that non-metal will take the electron from the metal, and that will release energy. And now, for some reason, this is explained, but the actual idea that an electron falling into a fluorine releases energy is sort of waived. We sort of do difference to quantum mechanics by saying that an atom likes to have a full shell, and that's as close as we get to saying that the electrons have a shape, and because they have a shape at a particular angle and orientation, you can rotate that cloud of electrons and see at close range an exposed positive nucleus, which you can then insert a shaped electron into it. That's an F minus one. And so the F minus has got such a strong attraction to electrons that it is so strong it can actually rip an electron off a sodium. And so, for instance, you have sodium chloride, and that's got an energy which would encounter more energy if you had sodium fluoride, the fluorine has a greater electron affinity and will remove it. And so this entire process is that in your gas, you have heated up some electrons have to come from somewhere. They don't come from sodium sodium because it's sodium plus. You put sodium chloride in. It actually has to heat up from other gas particles. There can be electrons floating from other parts. And also, if you heat it up sufficiently strong, you can actually release an electron from your non-metal. That is, you can heat it up so much that your non-metal ionizes. So if your non-metal ionizes, it releases an electron, and that electron can recombine and deionize. Recombine is the term for it with the sodium. So there's a whole series of things. So intensity can increase. So if you had a salt of sodium iodide, it may be easier to produce electrons, and the yellow will increase in intensity, perhaps. But the important thing with salt is that to really understand it, you have to combine ionization energy and electron affinity. Now, we have the thing that when the salt comes together, I have another thing, which is called electron affinity, which only refers to atomic, not electron affinity, electron negativity, which only refers to bonds. And it actually says if you have two atoms bonded together, you can actually, by just applying the electron negativity to each of those atoms, the one which is more electronegative will actually have the electron in its molecular orbital more in its actual region, or be closer to that atom. So if I have sodium chloride and chlorine is more electronegative, it will actually attract the electron across and create a polarized bond. So a more polarized bond is an ionic bond, a evenly shared bond, it's a covalent bond. So electron negativity is a way of, rather than having a digital thing, it's a more sliding scale, which describes what's going on. So we have four tables to look at and activate. The one is the standard periodic table, then the ionization energy, which tells you which is going to produce the light, the electron affinity, which says how much an electron is attracted to a neutral atom. And this is something which we tend to hide because this is something which is mind-boggling. I have a neutral thing, a neutral, say, an electron, and there's no energy between those two things because there's no net charge. But if I push it close enough, that electron will actually see a positive charge through the electron cloud, so to speak, come through and release energy. Now, I'm not making this up. If I was, there wouldn't be a table of electron affinity. There wouldn't be all the chemistry. It wouldn't be a direction of chemistry. It's just not a popularly explained thing. So I do counsel against people who say, look, I've got a new insight that everyone's missed. No, this is an old insight which a lot of people know about, but it's not put forward because it's inconvenient if you haven't got sufficient grounding to describe it. So we've got three tables so far, and then the fourth table is the mix between the two, which says the electron negativity, that's when it's at a bond distance where the electron will spend the greatest amount of time, or the effective position of electron, where it spends a greater amount of time is one way of looking at it. If you do a time-independent Schrodinger equations for it, obviously where it spends the most amount of time doesn't make sense. It means in the time-independent Schrodinger equations for writing bonds, it's more the actual shape, the charge distribution of the molecular orbital. The charge distribution physically is shaped will be more over a particular region, so the electron won't, say, spend 10% of its time on the the sodium and 90% of the time it's in the fluorine, and then be on and off, and, you, and Heisenberg uncertainty principle says you can't see where it is. That, again, that's unnecessary to call that up. The actual shape of the electron will be bulged over the chlorine and have a thinner amount or thinner density. Electron density will be less over the sodium. And so this really explains the following things. Basically explains that a salt put into a flame will produce a colour of an electron transition from an excited neutral state down to the neutral state. And so there's this chemical reaction of electron plus a charged ion goes to an excited ion, and the excited ion radiates down to the neutral state. And of course, that neutral state lasts a very short time because it's chemically reactive. It will react with something and then it will cycle through. So your sodium ion will produce light over and over again. In fact, you can actually trap your sodium in a street light and have a yellow street light. So if you go, and these are becoming increasingly rare, and they tend to put them in, I don't know what sections they put them in, they tend to put them in remote highway sections, or I don't know why they select sodium lamps, you'll see this beautiful yellow colour, and that's sodium trapped, and it's used over and over again, and it's not the hottest part of, necessarily the hottest part of the flame, which is producing the most light. It's the flame, it's the part of the flame where there's recombination going on. That's sodium plus an electron, and the electron has to come from somewhere. It goes through that state. So this is the necessary part of explaining the science. Obviously, you wouldn't explain this to kids on the first day of experiment. But then what sort of happens is that because you don't have to, the junior teachers don't have this deeper understanding, and then when you try and explain this deeper understanding, because there's no ever real career need to understand it, it doesn't go anywhere. And such is life. It's just in the process, the track of my life, I've had this heart operation, been a quantum physicist. I just quietly kept my cool, kept my counsel, kept my powder dry. Not that I'm going to actually explode at any point in time, and actually, if you like my powder, I just have let it go past. You know, that's what was life as it was, and it was going to be life wound up, and that was one of the things that saying, wouldn't it have been nicer if this happened? Of course, this remarkable thing, they've come in and cured me. I'm back here. And, of course, the world hasn't changed. I haven't been able to rock up to the education department and say, oh, look, this is the way it is. But as part of my cardiac rehab, it seems the only natural thing, this is sort of the genuine belief, my genuine understanding, why not try and practice explaining it. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on teaching science if you can, thinking science, and promoting it, promoting the actual understanding. Science with facts is just, I don't know, you may as well have a book. It's the understanding which leads to the enrichment and enjoyment.